ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the Science Show began over 50 years ago, Australia was seen as a strange leftover place.
But local science transformed everything. Australia is full of treasures, from birdsong to perhaps the world's first engineers.
That's why the Science Show is always full of surprises.
In the sky, in the lab, and even in your own backyard.
The Science Show, anytime on ABC Listen.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr, back in the chair after a bit of a break. Very, very grateful to Tracy Holmes, a professional filling in for this amateur. Tonight, rather a lot about Donald Trump, but how can we resist as he celebrates his 80th birthday watching half-naked wrestlers wallop each other on the White House lawns? All gold indoors and all biff in the garden. Not much reported here is his grudge against South Africa, which he reckons, with no proof at all, is conducting a white genocide. They are his words. So, these days, the only refugees he lets into the United States are white South Africans, the Afrikaner exodus. Meanwhile, Google wants to release 32 million sterilized mosquitoes in California and Florida each year for the next 2 or 3 years, in the hope that the population of mosquitoes bearing so many dreadful diseases will fade away. The United States government is making up its mind about Google's request. But first, a familiar voice on Late Night Live when her remit was merely Australia, Laura Tingle joins us once again, now that her beat is the world. And on such a day, when it seemed for a time that something, perhaps even a treaty, was about to be signed that would have oil flowing once more through the Straits of Hormuz. But then the Defence Minister of Israel spoke. Laura, what did he have to say?
David, he put out a statement late in the afternoon Australian time, so about 10 hours after the triumphant declarations of a deal. And he said that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and he were, this is all quotes, leading a clear policy that states that the Israeli Defence Forces will remain in the security zones in Lebanon, Syria and Gaza indefinitely in order to protect the border and Israeli communities from there against jihadist elements. He said the area will be cleared of local residents and all terrorist infrastructure above and below ground, including the houses in the contact villages that served as terrorist outposts, which will be destroyed. He said, this is the main lesson from the events of October 7, which obviously a reference to the attack on Israel over the border from Gaza. He says, seizing the territory and the security zones is one of the IDF's greatest achievements in the war of rebirth under the decisions and direction of the political echelon. That is why we oppose the IDF withdrawal from Lebanon, despite all the existing and future pressures. Prime Minister Netanyahu made this clear to the US President and other senior American officials. And I, meaning the Defence Minister, also made this clear yesterday to Secretary of War Pete Hegseth.
The war of rebirth.
I've got to say this was a new one on me, but apparently that's been what's going on. But
so that a new Israel is to emerge from all this fighting.
A very new Israel. So my take on this is that this is Israel saying not only up yours on the deal, because as far as Iran is concerned, not only is a ceasefire in Lebanon, but Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon non-negotiable, but they are declaring that they are staying in Gaza and that they are staying in the occupied Golan Heights as well as in Lebanon indefinitely. Now, of course, Israel doesn't have defined borders on its terms. It's never said what its borders are. Well, it's now telling us what they are.
Does this mean that the deal is off with Iran?
Well, we've got to yet see what Iran says, but for that matter, we've also got to see what the US says about this, because we've had the sort of theatre of Donald Trump coming out and saying, well, I stopped Iran responding to this bombing of southern Beirut by Israel on Sunday, our time. So it's made him look like a goose. It's also raised the question of whether he's got any capacity to influence Israel. It highlights the divergence in war aims of the US and Israel. And, of course, there were sort of various social media posts through the course of our day from various senior figures in the Iranian regime saying, we have our finger on the trigger and any further aggressions against either Lebanon or Gaza will be met by attacks on Tel Aviv and, I don't think they said Jerusalem, but, you know, attacks on major population centres in Israel. So this is, you know, if everybody talks their book, you know, we're looking at a return to full-scale war, at least between Israel and Iran, instead of just attacking in Lebanon or attacking the Gulf states, as opposed to, you know, the Americans necessarily getting involved.
The authorities that the United States has over Israel, its capacity to, in inverted commas, persuade Israel to stop these invasions in order that there can be peace in the Straits of Hormuz, that is the United States' huge financial contribution each year to Israel. Yeah. What would happen if the United States finally lost its bloc with Israel?
Well, I think there are two things. The immediate thing is the question of whether it would cut off armaments sales, brackets, subsidy, subsidised to Israel. I mean, it provides general support and it provides financial support for defence. Now, it's still very hard to imagine the Trump administration, at least, doing this. But you've got to sort of say it's a possibility. And, of course, the other thing is that, you know, Israel has a massive influence in the United States via its lobbying bodies. But that is starting to fall to pieces. We're seeing opinion turning radically, according to opinion polls, against Israel and to a more pro-Palestinian position amongst voters. You've also started to see Democrats and even Republicans in Congress critical of them. So I think the first round effects are that you might see a change to those defence relationships. But in the, you know, the bigger picture really is at some point, does the US actually become part of a global campaign to sanction Israel, not just to sanction individuals in Israel? Benjamin Netanyahu did a really fascinating interview with the American CBS network in the last couple of months. There was an hour, 20-minute version of it up on YouTube, which was fascinating for anybody to watch who's, you know, not really ever seen him in motion. And in part, he was saying there that he was quite relaxed with losing American support or not being dependent on American US defence support because he was expecting to get it from Gulf states. Now, I think one of the aspects of where we've got to since he gave that interview is that while it's all a little bit silent, the sort of pragmatic realities of this seem to be that the Gulf states have basically decided to fork out to stop Israel, to stop Iran bombing them. I mean, there's all this talk about that this deal would involve $24 billion worth of Iranian assets being unfrozen, with half of that to be paid up front. Now, there was some reports about that over the weekend, and the US is saying, no, that's definitely not true. Well, that might not be true, except most of that money is held in places like the UAE. And so, you know, decisions can be taken by individual states who have got to live with Iran and who are going to be much more pragmatic, who will just say, well, we've got to make our own decisions. Now, we don't know that for sure, but the direction is more towards a pragmatic accommodation and trading with between Iran and the Gulf rather than trading with Israel.
Meanwhile, that is a rebuff to the President of the United States delivered by the Prime Minister of Israel and his defence minister. Can you recall as open public rebuff of an American president as this?
By anybody. No, I can't. And particularly if you think about this particular trajectory, I mean, you know, there was that extraordinary New York Times reporting from Maggie Haberman and our own Jonathan Swan, which was all about how Netanyahu had gone into the Situation Room at the White House and sort of laid out this picture along with Mossad about, you know, we can get regime change and we just do this and we just do that. And Donald Trump said, sounds good to me. Essentially going from that position where for the first time the US actually went into a conflict with Israel as a joint combatant.
And Israel had asked just about every president in the last 20 years to do this, but
correct,
for the first time. And against, wasn't it, against the emphatic advice of Trump's military hierarchy.
I don't know how emphatic it was. I mean, as you say, I wasn't in the room when it happened, David, but I mean, the language, I always get a bit sceptical when all these people suddenly go, well, I said it was a bad idea. Well, I thought it was a bad idea and I sort of said so, but it was basically his decision.
If you could have read my eyes, yes.
So I think everybody's done a bit of covering of backsides on that, but it clearly wasn't emphatic enough that anybody felt that they had to resign or, you know, and even I think the Joint Chief of Staff person whose name momentarily escapes me was a bit fudgy on it and was briefing out afterwards. Oh, no, well, it was the president's, mm-hmm, commander-in-chief's decision and we were just presenting scenarios.
Do you think Donald, on one of his sleepless nights, which seemed to be every night, it crosses his mind, he rather regrets going in? What was the operation called, by the way? Thumping Heart or
Fury,
something?
Something. And then, of course, somebody said that the Israeli version was Roaring Lion, and somebody was joking about it being sort of a smacked cat or something now. But
now it's Operation Rebirth.
The War of Rebirth. Seems to have been, I'm going to have to Google it afterwards just
to
see where
it's stated. I'm fascinated by these names. Who makes them up? What, you know, who are the staffers that decide Thor's Hammer and Thumping Heart and this?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
This is ABC Radio National, Late Night Live, David Marr talking to, of course, Laura Tingle. Laura, putting aside for a moment this extraordinary spanner that has been thrown into the works, was there much in this supposed treaty yet to be signed, yet to be, for us yet to know the text?
I think the main things that were in it were that both sides agreed that there was a deal, which sort of may have been a little bit premature by the looks of things, and that there was supposed to be this signing agreement. So they've both put themselves under some pressure here. They're still saying that they're going to have a signing agreement unless something's happened in the last 15 seconds to have a deal in Switzerland on Friday, which puts them both under a lot of pressure. Now, one of the interesting things about that, and I won't keep going on about Israel too much, but one of the things was that because Israel was bombing Southern Beirut, Donald Trump intervened with Netanyahu. They were claiming that he'd persuaded Iran not to retaliate.
Yes.
But apparently he did that by guaranteeing the borders of Lebanon. So, you know, this really embarrasses him. But the rest of it, it's one of those, we're basically in this war of spin now, of course. Iran, once again, seems to be better at it. Like, they're leaking out these 14 points, which we haven't had a full confirmation of, but the US isn't going out saying, no, none of that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
But the crucial bits are Strait of Hormuz, which is what most people are interested in. And on the Strait of Hormuz, essentially it's Donald Trump saying there won't be any...
No
tolls. What he's not saying is that apparently Iran will still run the strait.
Iran will decide which boats arrive and the manner...
Yes.
In which they come.
Indeed. It will have some sort of management system. So, you know, that's a back down and a compromise. There's talk of a $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran, which we're not hearing very much about. This $24 billion unfreezing of funds, of sanctions being lifted, you know, which provide this new opportunity to be friendly between the Americans and the Iranians. The interesting thing also is on nuclear policy.
Uranium. Wasn't it all supposed to be about...
It was all supposed to be about
regime change in Iran and getting hold of the uranium.
Yep.
Regime and change looks...
That's not happening.
That's not happening. What about the uranium?
Uranium, the Iranians have said, Trump saying, well, it's great because the Iranians have committed to not develop or buy any nuclear weapons, which is fine, except they've been saying that for at least a decade, whether you believe them or not. And there is very little talk about what they've said about enrichment. Now, Donald Trump spoke to the New York Times at some point in the last 24 hours and sort of said, oh, well, you know, there may be some sort of limit on how much enrichment they can do, you know, to what extent. And there's a question about whether they will be stopped from enriching for 15 years or 20 years, but it's all pretty nebulous, I think, at this point. There's also no mention of what happens to the ballistic missile program, which is another key issue for the Israelis. So, you know, it's a pretty bad deal for the United States in terms of the fact that they haven't achieved any of their war aims. And in fact, we're probably going backwards, given these changing dynamics under the surface in the Gulf and everywhere else.
So to sum up, Laura, it looked like a rotten deal, but that rotten deal may have been torpedoed by the Israelis.
Yes.
So it seems to me, and I defer to your expertise on this, that we're back where we started.
We are. I think we're back to where we started. We'll have to just wait. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about time zones. We had to wait all day till the Israelis woke up to find out what they were going to say, but it was never going to be good. Now we've got to wait for Trump to get out of his cage fighting and, you know, back into his sleepless nights to find out what he thinks, and also to find out what the Iranians are going to do.
Laura, thanks so much for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
I love to be the bearer of such good news, David Marr.
I have been speaking to Laura Tingle, Global Affairs Editor of the ABC. Coming up, Donald Trump's grudge against South Africa. The vicious politics of the Mexican border have for a long time obscured the fact that traditionally the United States is a quite welcoming country for refugees. In Biden's time, 125,000 came each year. But Trump has all but shut the door. In the last 8 months, he has allowed only about 6,500 into the country. And all but three of those, not 3,000, but three, were white South Africans, Afrikaners, fleeing what Trump calls a white genocide. To explore Trump's quarrel with South Africa, we're joined by Lauren Landau, Professor of Migration at Oxford, who also holds a chair at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. Lauren, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for the invitation.
Lauren, what's Trump's evidence for this white genocide?
Trump's evidence of the white genocide bears all of the hallmarks of his normal evidence. It's based on conspiracy theories. It's based on things he's seen online or somebody has told him. And it is easily refutable. And it has been refuted not only by people in the United States, not only by the South African government, but even by many Afrikaners themselves.
Last year, he had the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, in the Oval Office. What happened?
What we saw was a similar thing to what he had done to President Zelensky just a few weeks before. He invited him for a visit, part of a state visit, to discuss important issues. And there is important trade between South Africa and the United States. And then he ambushed Cyril Ramaphosa, presenting him with sheets of paper, ostensibly outlining the crimes against white Afrikaners, showing pictures of them in line fleeing from, ostensibly fleeing from violence, and documents that outlined all of the murders and the killings that have happened. Cyril Ramaphosa, I think, was expecting this. He found ways of deflecting it, but of course it was intended, and I think succeeded, to be a humiliating exchange.
But why would Trump want to humiliate the president of South Africa?
I think there's a few reasons. I mean, one is the more general attitude he has towards African countries. He said extraordinarily derogatory things about many African countries in the past, and this is in line with his general attitude, his racism, his frustration with Africa. More specifically, I think South Africa represents something he doesn't like, especially more recently, where South Africa has taken Israel to the International Criminal Court with accusations of genocide in Gaza. That is something that upset Trump and many of his allies. But I think the real reason here is about Trump trying to perform for his base, to try to show that he is not only controlling immigration, but is the sort of bully, the big man in the room. And any chance that he has to humiliate somebody, especially if it's someone who is black or brown, I think speaks to that base.
But there are reasons, are there not, that Afrikaners might wish to leave the country. And I was in Cape Town before Christmas, and I heard stories of terrible violence, everyday violence in the outskirts of Cape Town, but in other cities and places in South Africa as well. You may well want to get away from that and live in another country.
I think there's very good reasons Afrikaners would want to leave or would want to escape the violence. But that applies to all South Africans. If you look at the crime rate in the country, it's extraordinary by civilian levels. Sometimes the civilian death rate echoes those that you would see in a war zone. But most of that violence is, of course, affecting the black or colored community in South Africa. White South Africans are often less victimized because they tend to be wealthier. Afrikaners who live in farming areas have been victimized. But even there, if we look at what they call farm killings, the number of people killed is not disproportionate to Afrikaners. Everyone is at risk. Does that mean they don't have a reason to leave? Of course they do. If you had the opportunity to go to the United States, which is a richer country, which, despite Trump's best efforts, has greater economic prospects and services, you would do so. And I think many of the Afrikaners who are going are doing so simply opportunistically, knowing very well that they are not fleeing a genocide.
Is the government stripping white farmers of land? I mean, we remember 20 or 30 years ago now, after Zimbabwe got independence, it just 14, 15 million hectares of land was just stripped from white farmers. Is there some program like that afoot in South Africa?
Since 1994, since the end of apartheid, the government has actively sought to transfer land ownership from a wealthy and previously privileged white landowning class to people who had been dispossessed, to the country's black majority. Oddly, despite that being a policy, it's been relatively unsuccessful, and only a few percentage of land has, in fact, been transferred. So we're not seeing a massive program. There are discussions about new initiatives to try to encourage, to try to force land redistribution to repossess, but at pay farmers, but involuntarily take their land. There is some murmurings of that. But South Africans, white South Africans, black South Africans who own land are protected by constitutional principles, by rights of private property. And to my knowledge, there's been almost no cases in which people have lost a farm or agricultural land involuntarily due to a government program.
So those who've gone to the United States are not farmers stripped of land, but who are they? Are they farmers? Are they shopkeepers? Are they lawyers? Who is making the break?
I haven't seen a full breakdown of the demography of the groups that's going. I knew a bit. I listened to interviews with the first group that arrived 6 or 8 months ago in the United States. And some of them were indeed farmers. Some of them seemed to be professionals. Many of them were leaving behind five-story houses and large, multiple cars, doing very well. Some of them, of course, will have been suffering. And Afrikaners have traditionally been the less educated, less wealthy, in some instances, a part of the country's white population. But if we look at the people who are moving, the people who get selected to the United States, there will be filters on that. The poorest, the least educated won't be invited to the United States. So I think what we're looking at is a landowning class, a wealthy, prosperous, highly educated population who the U.S. government thinks will manage to survive once they arrive.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Lauren Landau, Professor of Migration and Development at Oxford, about Trump's quarrel with South Africa and the only refugees now reaching the United States, white South Africans. Lauren, what does it matter to the wider world that South Africa and the United States get along reasonably, amicably? Is there anything great at stake here?
There's many things. One, just generally, relationships between Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and the United States. South Africa has been a strong ally of the United States on many fronts, fighting disease, fighting poverty, promoting development, promoting humanitarian responses across the continent. That allyship has clearly lessened, and that weakening will weaken the whole continent's relationship with the United States. I think there are also moral issues here, where both countries have been very strongly in favor of human rights issues, promoting inclusivity, queer rights, for example, women's rights across the continent. And that has also eroded. I think more specifically, what we're seeing is an erosion of the international refugee and asylum system. Of course, that's been under assault in Europe, in the United States, Australia, and in South Africa for many years. But this breaking down of this resettlement system, of something that was critically important to people around the world, also sends a clear message that the United States leadership is no longer what it was, that the United States is not as welcoming as it once was, but also that the United States is not an ally if you're interested in fighting for questions of justice or protection.
What role in this do you think Elon Musk might be having?
I think Elon Musk and potentially even Elon's father seem to have very influential, have the ear of the president, or they did at the time that this policy was rolled out. He has been an advocate, together with a number of other white South Africans, of the position that there's a genocide, that white South Africans are being unfairly discriminated against, dispossessed, disempowered. He has not made himself popular with many South Africans for that, but I think that narrative echoes what's already within Trump's head, his perceptions of what is happening on the continent, what's happening in South Africa. And it allows Trump to position himself as a savior of the white people.
I'm curious, do you know whether Musk still has a South African passport?
I'm not sure, for example. I know that he's wealthy enough that he travels wherever he likes to go and usually welcome. But I don't know what he carries when he travels.
Was he a kid when he left?
He wasn't a kid. He went to study in the United States, didn't enroll. If I understand, he was meant to go to Stanford, then stayed on, oddly, as an undocumented migrant for many years and started his business. And of course, at some point was able to gain the right to stay in the United States and I believe is now a U.S. citizen. But I'm not sure if he ever gave up his passport from South Africa.
Has there, in fact, been a flood of applicants to get out of South Africa and resettle in the United States?
There was a surprising number of people who applied. When they first announced this policy, it coincided with the time when the Trump administration had shut down refugee resettlement entirely at a global level. So I know people in the Pretoria embassy were actually struggling with what to do, because on one hand, they were told they were resettling white Afrikaners. On the other, they were told they were not going to resettle anyone. And they struggled not just because of that confusion, but because of the number of people who had applied. So if you look at the thousands who have already been slated to go or are going to the United States, I think that represents a small percentage of those who've applied. And I understand those numbers are in the tens of thousands.
And as you said, it'll all be whittled down to those who finally go. There has been an open letter written by South Africans, making it clear that they're standing apart from all of this. Has that had, who did it, and has that had much impact?
Right. Almost immediately, one of the trade unions, Solidarity, and other groups who actually represent specifically Afrikaners and the Afrikaans community, distanced themselves from this policy. They wanted to tell South Africa, not only the United States, that they saw their future in South Africa, that while they may have grievances against the government, they may have concerns about crime, as you say, about land dispossession, that they are committed to the South African project and building a South African future. So even the people who are most closely aligned with the groups that are going to the United States have largely rejected this offer. Of course, the broader South African community does find this a humiliation, which it's intended to be, and I think also is committed to ensuring that people who need protection from Africa or elsewhere in the world are able to go to the United States. But I think this is really about sending a message to the world that while South Africa has deep problems, unemployment, crime, inequality, that South Africans are committed to building that future, whether they're white or black or Afrikaans.
What are the numbers of white and black South Africans?
Well, the total population is about 60 million, so it's a fairly substantial country. The number, the percentage of white South Africans has decreased, but largely because of the birth rates are lower among the white population. Yep. So it's now under about 10%.
Right. And the division in that community between the sort of British background and Dutch background?
Right. I think that the Dutch background is definitely in the minority, although they've been much more committed to South Africa. So while many people with, let's say, British colonial heritage or Commonwealth heritage were able to leave, and for many years they could travel and go to Britain quite easily without even visas or claim passports based on that. Many have left. Somewhere over a million white South Africans have left since 1994. Most of those would have been British. So Afrikaners are in the minority, even among the white population, but they are a very visible and very important part of that grouping.
And is Trump welcoming the Afrikaners or whites in general?
He's made it very specific about the Afrikaners, that they, I guess, as a farming community historically, have been targeted, that they are losing their land. It is a, he has not welcomed white South Africans in general, at least not through the refugee system, although I think he would welcome highly educated white South Africans in a way that he would definitely not wish to welcome black South Africans.
It's peculiarly focused, isn't it? But presumably, if you're rich enough, you can get there however you care. Australia has, of course, welcomed many, many people from South Africa. But a couple of decades ago, there was a program here offering refugee status to white farmers from South Africa. And my memory is that it was a complete fizzer. Nobody particularly wanted to go.
Yeah, I mean, Western Australia particularly, I believe Perth has an enormous number of South Africans living in that area, many of them who came to work in the mining sector, which of course South Africans have a deep experience with. But yeah, I think at that time, 20 years ago, South Africa, it was a much more optimistic place economically. And as I've said, people, most South Africans are deeply committed to building the country's future and to ensuring that they have a place in that future. I think we're looking at a different sort of era and a different time when communitarian attitudes, people are playing identity cards, they're relying on that as a way of organizing politics. That feels much stronger now than it has in the past, and Trump is playing on that. And perhaps if Australia reopened this pathway now, you might have a different response.
Why is there such violence in South Africa?
I think there's many reasons. Of course, South Africa has, we forget, it's only recently come out of something that was very close to a civil war. It was a peaceful transition in 1994, but leading up to that, there was wide-scale, if not sort of overarching violence. There was a lot of violence on the street. There were a lot of guns. There were a lot of gangsters. And a lot of that has continued. Those same political organizations have continued. They still work in the townships. But I think the real reason behind all of this is just the massive inequality. It is up there with Brazil. They fight for the top of the table in the most unequal countries in the world. Like Brazil, that inequality is highly racial, with white people being at the top and black people falling below. And while South Africa has made progress in creating a black middle class and uplifting some, it also now has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world and a youth unemployment rate that is in the 30 to 40% range, depending on how you count. When you have that kind of a growing population, most in cities, a widespread amount of guns, a corrupt police, you're going to have crime.
Is South Africa also experiencing an influx of refugees?
Yes, South Africa has the highest number of African migrants, not necessarily the highest number of refugees, but the highest number of African migrants of any country in the world. So while Europe has responded very, very strongly against the number of people coming there, South Africa has many more. Most of them are from the region. Most of them are there to work. There are historical hundreds of years of migrant labor systems in the region, and the region is dependent on that. It has also a progressive refugee policy, or has had, and has accepted 100,000 or more refugees from the region, from Congo, from Somalia, from South Sudan, from elsewhere on the continent. So there is a big number, and there's widespread, like there is elsewhere, popular resistance to people coming in when so many South Africans are themselves suffering.
Yes, yes. Lauren, look, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
I've been speaking to Lauren Landau, Professor of Migration and Development at Oxford. He also has a chair at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. Coming up, Google takes on the mosquito. Mosquitoes are the deadliest animals on the planet. They kill more people every year than every other animal on Earth combined. They carry dengue fever, Zika virus, yellow fever, West Nile virus, and so many other nasties that infect hundreds of millions of people every year. And the most dangerous mozzies, thanks to climate change, are heading south. They'll be in Brisbane soon. To combat the drift, we've been using a technique involving AI that's had promising results in Queensland. The same technique is about to be employed on a huge scale in California and Florida. But it's not a public health initiative. The Debug Program, as it's called, is owned by Google. To discuss the mozzie threat, how it can be met, and the implications of Google's role, I'm joined by Associate Professor Gordana Rasic, Head of Mosquito Genomics at QIMR Berghofer. That's the Queensland Institute of Medical Research. Gordana, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
Gordana, why is Google mixed up in this? Why do we have this unexpected player?
Google is an interesting player indeed, because we never thought that there is money to be made in controlling mosquitoes. Usually that's the sort of task of local councils or mosquito control districts in the US. And you generally get your money from the federal government to deal with these pesky creatures all the time, and it's a drain on your budget. And it depends on the time of the year, depends on the year. Sometimes the issues are worse, sometimes they're not. And there is that kind of unpredictability around what to do with mosquitoes and how to effectively control them. So I was personally surprised, I have to say, when such a big tech giant really showed up as one of the key players nowadays in sort of the new ways of controlling mosquitoes, which we all know is needed. But I personally, as you say, I am kind of surprised that it's interesting from a business point of view to a company like Google.
What is the new technique?
So it's based on a bacterium called Wolbachia, which is really a biological marvel. And this bacterium is found only in mosquitoes and other arthropods. So it's completely harmless to humans. And so, for example, in a dengue fever mosquito, the one that also transmits Zika, chikungunya, these really nasty viruses, there are no Wolbachia in natural populations. And so what we first thought is that by introducing this Wolbachia into the mosquito, we will actually shorten the lifespan of a mosquito, make it sterile, and so on. But what it turned out to be is that actually it blocks the virus in the mosquitoes. It kind of immunizes mosquito against transmitting these deadly or dangerous viruses. So that's how the whole Wolbachia sort of story started. And one flavor of that technology is used by Google, which is if you only release male mosquitoes that carry this bacterium, and I remind you that male mosquitoes don't bite, so you release male mosquitoes that don't bite, they have that Wolbachia, and their only really goal in life is to find female mosquitoes and to mate with them. So what they do is when they mate with natural sort of free-flying local female mosquitoes, they create offspring that's not viable. So basically by releasing many of these male mosquitoes, you're saturating the local population. All of the female mosquitoes are mating with your released males, and all of their or most of their offspring dies. So over time, you're basically sterilizing the local population, and eventually it can completely crash.
But how do you tell a male mosquito from a female mosquito?
There are differences, very obvious one, when they're adults. And so what Verily does is it actually sorts males from females based on these morphological characters. So males have much more kind of elaborate antennae. They're slightly smaller. So they have these morphological features that are obvious to a human eye, but no human would be able to sort many millions of mosquitoes that are needed for this technology to be released. So they have a bunch of cameras and a bunch of these little tubes that mosquitoes fly through. And then they sort of by AI look at every mosquito and then release males onto the one side, females onto the other. And that's how they sort them.
It sounds a bit like sorting lambs through a race, but a little bit more scientifically. What would be the problem of releasing females as well as males?
In Queensland in 2011, the Wolbachia project was in fact releasing both males and females. So what that does is introduces that bacterium through females into the entire population. And what that does is it kind of immunizes mosquitoes against transmitting these viruses. So they will be biting you. They will be there. You will not be eliminating them, but they will be far less likely to cause any outbreak or any epidemic.
It's just much more dangerous if the females are completely exposed to this virus.
Exactly. So the idea is if you release only males with Wolbachia, you will then basically sort of suppress or potentially even eliminate the population. So if you are really careful and do not release any females, then over time you should crash a local mosquito population, almost like using an insecticide or a biopesticide, right? But if you want to sort of have a sustained release of both males and females over time, Wolbachia will actually take over the entire mosquito population. And then you don't have to do much, anything after that. So mosquitoes now, dengue mosquitoes in Cairns, in Townsville, almost all of them carry this bacterium. And we have a really good evidence that's why we don't have any more outbreaks in Cairns and Townsville for dengue.
How long have these mosquitoes been being released in Cairns and Townsville?
The releases have happened back in 2011 in Cairns, and that was the first trial. The idea with Verily, and that was actually tried in partnership with CSIRO in 2017 and 18, where you release only males and potentially completely crash the population, that was trialed in Innisfail. in 2017. And actually, it was very successful locally. That small trial was really good. So what the Google wants to do now in the US is just do it on a whole completely new level.
And to explain, Verily is the Google company.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Verily, exactly. Debug Verily is the company that is actually doing these mosquito technologies, but they are a subsidiary of Google. Yes.
Right. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Associate Professor Gordana Rasic about the mosquito menace. Gordana, what are the mosquitoes that we must take most care about, the ones that we really need to stop?
Those are the two most invasive mosquitoes and most dangerous one, which is the Asian tiger mosquito called Aedes albopictus and a dengue mosquito, Aedes aegypti. Why are they so invasive? They are really good at sticking around humans. They love us and they love our artificial containers, tires, plant pots, and they use those habitats to, when they leave their eggs, to breed their larvae there. So they really don't mind slight pollution. They can go in plain cargo ships. So you can imagine that those eggs that can actually be dry for months and months can be distributed all across the globe. So we had dengue outbreaks at the beginning of the 20th century in Brisbane.
How did they deal with those Brisbane mosquitoes? I mean, there's not dengue in Brisbane now.
So what happened in the 1950s, basically after the Second World War, public health campaigns were really, really ongoing and sustained and lasted for years, where they basically made these open breeding habitats very restricted. Rainwater tanks were really properly sealed. So there was this mass campaign of just huge awareness. And so what happened over time is by the late 50s, we no longer had this mosquito in Brisbane.
But dangerous mosquitoes, you predict, will soon be back.
They are constantly at our door because they are showing up in our airports, in our seaports. They can also be transported via cargo from northern Queensland. So that's why we are kind of thinking about new ways to really prevent their incursion, because we don't want these mosquitoes to be back in our major cities.
Will you be using this new technique that Google owns?
We were actually modeling just in silico on the computer. What would it take to eliminate mosquitoes in these southernmost Australian populations, which are just now 200 kilometers north of Brisbane? And what we found with our simulations is that this Google technology can work pretty well if you are releasing constantly over several months, twice a week. You release a lot of mosquitoes in these small towns and multiple towns simultaneously. But you will, in none of our simulations, we would get a complete elimination. So what happens? You stop and then the numbers come back after a while. But when we started simulating on another sort of intervention that goes slightly ahead of the Verily technology, which is just plain common rainwater tank sealing. So public health compliance, where people really take care of their rainwater tanks and make sure that mosquitoes can't enter and breed there. Following that campaign, if we then simulated the Verily campaign, we would be able to actually eliminate mosquitoes for a much longer period of time. So it is possible to use that technology, and probably is one of the very viable options for a region like a region north of Brisbane. But we haven't done any economical kind of assessment of how much that would cost.
What are your concerns about a private company running programs of this kind?
There's always a concern of trust and ownership and reliance on something that is not public good. So obviously, private companies have their own incentives, and their incentives don't necessarily match the incentives of public. We hope that they would, especially in programs like these. But a public-private partnership is something that needs to be really well regulated, in a sense that who controls how things are deployed, when to stop, what is the quality control assurance, who owns the data that is being collected. Because whenever you're doing these kind of campaigns, you have heaps of data that you collect. When do you stop? Who determines the price? Who determines the consent, right? So these are all issues that really need to be carefully thought out and planned with communities and public health offices, at least in my opinion.
When, if these techniques don't ultimately stop the drift of mosquitoes south, when could we have dengue fever in Sydney and Melbourne? Got any idea?
So climate change predictions say that we already have pretty good environmental conditions per se for these mosquitoes to be there, even further south as Melbourne. What is not accounted in these climate scenarios is the change in human behavior, change in urbanization, all the other things that go along climate change that sort of increase the probability of a disease outbreak. You have to know that disease dengue will not show up if there is no vector, right? So we have to first have the mosquito there, and we can work hard on preventing it from establishing, or at least catching it very early on and trying to really control it very well before it becomes widespread everywhere. We really think that so far we've been successful in preventing that, and I have a strong belief that we can in the future. But it's really about if some local establishments occur, what would be the best approach to deal with that? And so certainly Verily's technology is one of the solutions. The other one would be something that probably public wouldn't like either too much, but that's what things are dealt with right now, which is application of insecticides. So you really have to go into people's backyards and have their permission to enter their backyard, inspect the mosquito breeding sites, apply insecticides on surfaces, and so on. So that's another solution, which is effective, but is also very intrusive.
But we're not there yet.
We're not there yet, and we really work hard. All the local councils, public health offices are working really hard. But this is really where we want our communities to be the key stakeholders. It's really up to us to be vigilant and to be on the lookout for these mosquitoes, because if we catch them early, we can stop them.
Gordana, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Associate Professor Gordana Rusic, Head of Mosquito Genomics at QIMR Berghofer. That's the Queensland Institute of Medical Research. And that's the show. On our next, Bruce Shapiro will be taking us through the twists and turns of the next 24 hours in the United States, with Trump trying to wind down Operation Epic Fury as Netanyahu revs up his war of rebirth. What a mess. We're also looking at the Indigenous last stand to save Brisbane Parks from the Olympics. That's next time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.